Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just 15 bucks a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Talk about the VOD and the silver screen. Kevin and Tom and Joe know all there is to know, from masterpieces to deep fried tacos. And if the movie sucks, you might hear them say, there's no telling where the guys will take you. Get ready for a spoiler. Won't say it twice, cause we already warned you. Better watch out.
Broadcasting from the lush but not lavish studios located in the basement of the O'Keefe Institute for Advanced Film Snarkitude, this is Real Spoilers, episode 753, Weisenheimer, the Mo Howard story.
Mm-hmm.
Joe is out this week, so we will go around the table officially this way.
Would you like me to start? Am I enough of a regular that I can just start right off?
We'll just let you start.
This is Paul.
This is Kevin.
And this is Tom. So Paul is kind enough to sit in because Joe is out this week. From what I understand, he somehow got it. The idea that Oppenheimer was a musical.
Oh, and so Oppenheimer the musical.
He refused to go
see
it.
It's a bomb. It's a bomb. Wow, look at that bomb.
Yeah, he all of a sudden got sick when he thought that we had to review the musical.
So I guess before we dig in proper, let's just do shameless plugs. Don't forget we're available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google, iHeart, TuneIn, wherever you find a podcast. You can find us. While you're there, be sure and follow us so you never miss an episode. Maybe leave us a review. That's always super helpful. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/realspoilers. While you're there, like the page, join the group. It's called the League of Show Sharers because we're hoping you'll share an episode. People who were kind enough to share an episode last week include Gus Buttisi.
See,
when Joe's not here, his dad shares the show. We don't know why that is. We will let you draw your own conclusions. Gabriel Lugo, Glenn Cougar, Melon Brewer, Chris Valls, Ralph Tribble, Travis T. Witt, Chris Magic Man, Tom Dowdy, Tammy Lynn Powers, Betts, Phil Timon, Heather Sachs, Dissect That Film, Brent Smith, Christopher Rex, Taylor Ward, Julianne Jordan, Edit Photo Gamer, Ryan Terry, Vertigay, 314, Invasion of the Remake, Spoiler Piece Theater, Mike and Oscar, The Film Bee, Ronnie Castle, Nostalgia Cast, Feel and Film, Geek to Me Radio, Binge Movies, and Matt Naglia. So thank you very much.
Wow, your sharing list has gone exponential.
Yeah,
over
it's
the
getting
years.
Larger. It's great. Yeah, it's nice.
Congratulations.
And we had a good movie last week, too. Like, right, that's Barbie. They're all sharing. So people were very excited about it. That also seems to play a role. Mm-hmm. So
we're going to start having Joe do it in song form.
Yeah.
You know,
like how Dan used to create new songs for any.
We'll do the Pirates of Penzance. I am the very model of a modern
Major General.
Major General. We'll have him do that with it. They used to do that on Tiny Toons. Joe would get that reference, but on Tiny Toons.
He would only understand that as a Tiny Toons.
That's what, it's a Tiny Toons. Yeah. So they did that where they would do, like, I don't know, or like the Elements song with Tom Lehrer.
Yeah.
When he would do that. So, but we'll have him do that with all the names. He'll assemble it the night before. So
sounds
great.
Also, don't forget we have a Patreon, patreon.com/realspoilers, where for $5 a month you get bonus content and we secretly like you extra, except it's not secret. And finally, don't forget you can watch these episodes on YouTube. So there's all that. let's dig in, since there's no Joe who has to synopsisize this monster of a movie.
You know, I think this is one that maybe doesn't need to necessarily be synopsisized. I don't think Christopher Nolan synopsisized
this. This is Kevin saying, not me.
Yeah. But it just, the way that it jumps around in time and all that. Yeah. But you know what? I was thinking, so this movie's 3 hours long, and I don't know about you guys. To me, it did not feel 3 hours long. It did not, but you tell me.
I think it felt like it was a brisk 2:45. I like this movie. The way people are jizzing all over it, I don't get. I think that it's okay. I definitely don't think it felt like a 3 hour movie, but I also didn't walk out of there feeling like, oh my God, has it already been three? I didn't do that either. But
so I got my work cut out for me, is what you're saying.
I think this movie is not a masterpiece. I think there's a lot of there's a lot of good stuff in this movie, and there's a lot of weird stuff in this movie.
And a lot of wasted time, too.
Yeah.
Christopher Nolan is an auteur.
Yeah.
Auteur is a French word, means doesn't edit enough.
Yeah.
He's the Judd Apatow of drama.
And the frustrating part is, I feel like he was really trying. Right? Like, I feel like the first 45 minutes of this movie plays like a trailer for this movie. I felt like there wasn't one scene where anybody talked for longer than 4 seconds. It was just like, you'd get this burst of like, this happened, and then now you're over here and this other thing happened.
Well, so the reason and why I wanted to ask you guys that I think it didn't feel like 3 hours is the editing. I think that if you would have had people sitting in a room and it went chronologically and they're just talking and talking and talking, I think you would be like, man, this is long. Jumping around between his point of view to Strauss's point of view to black and white to color. To me, I felt like I was keeping engaged. I was following it, but I had to do a little work to.
He did a really good job, I think, of letting you know where you were at in time. Like, I was never confused when it bounced around in time about where I was at in time.
And there's a lot going on. So I think they did a good job, and it kept you engaged.
I think he was trying too hard to have like, take a historical drama and have like a twist at the end, like, surprise, Robert Downey Jr.'s the bad guy.
And I really liked it because I don't know that story. Yeah. I'm not super familiar with the history of it all. Obviously the Cliff's Notes of it, but I didn't know all that. And I didn't know about Strauss, and I didn't know about these hearings and the communist stuff, like all the goings on and his affiliation. So to me, I felt like I was getting this kind of history lesson, but it was really engaging. I think Cillian Murphy's performance was phenomenal. And honestly, everyone, this cast is stacked from top to bottom.
I agree. Yeah. But when I say that he's not a good editor, I don't necessarily mean the film. I mean, he wrote the script.
Right.
And he jammed too much stuff into the script. I think if he hands it off to somebody else, they'll say, this whole part at the beginning with his first love, Jean Tatlock, in which we essentially hired Florence Pugh to show her nipples in a couple of scenes. That's all she's there for. She's just in a couple of nude scenes.
The sex scenes are so weird in this movie.
Yes.
So weird.
And the whole story of his relationship with her, I don't need to know that. Get me to Los Alamos.
Or
start there.
You can know that in a much more condensed fashion. Like, you know, like, this movie's in a weird spot from its runtime standpoint, in that I felt like it either needed to be shorter or longer. Like, because when you start introducing some of these ancillary characters, they have very interesting stories too.
Yes.
And I'm like, this might have made a really, really good miniseries.
Yeah, limited
like,
series on Netflix.
Yeah, like
or
9 or 10 episodes where you can take one of these other scientists.
This week, Edmund Teller.
Right. Yeah. And like go down that rabbit hole because there's some interesting things. And there's some interesting things that get completely left out. Like, I forget which guy it is, but the guy who they're working with the radioactive ball and it falls and he catches it.
Mm-hmm.
And he's just like, well, I'm begot. Like, I'm dead now.
Yep.
Like, he's like, you can't touch this thing, and he's dead in 2 weeks. And he spends the whole 2 weeks basically letting them watch what happens when you get radiation poisoning, right? Like, he's like, because we don't know yet. So he's like, okay, you're going to put me in a room, and you're going to watch what happens and log as much as you can so maybe you can help the next guy. And, like, it doesn't even touch on that story, which you do get in Fat Man and Little Boy.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because before I wrote my review for my website, I went back and I watched Fat Man and Little Boy, which, for those of you who don't know, Paul Newman plays John General Cusack. Groves,
yeah.
And he hires Dwight Schultz, face from the A-Team, who's playing Oppenheimer, to run this whole project. And he brings in other people, including John Cusack and John C. McGinley and a bunch of other people. And it's a story about they went to Los Alamos and made a bomb. That's right. The whole movie.
It's like the middle part of this movie.
Correct. Yeah. And I didn't mind what came after that in this movie, which we'll get to. But it's that first third,
yeah.
That whole, you know, him going through the academic history of where he was and the whole Einstein thing. Okay.
I don't know, because the implications of what he did are obviously so unfathomable for a human to be able to reconcile with. And I think to show him, to humanize this character so that we remember, well, this guy that created this horribly destructive, amazing, catastrophic thing was a guy, and then he had to live with that. And I think the Florence Pugh stuff helps to humanize him, but also they have to connect the story with the communism and the reason why they thought that he was, you know, that was like one of the smoking guns of like, oh, well, you went back to see her and you're in contact with her, a known communist. And then also, obviously, her suicide, quote unquote, was questionable because she ends up dying, but she's like in front of the tub, face down. And then they even show in the movie, like, he's picturing what happened. I think it's like a flash of it. You see a glove or something, like someone put her head in there. But it's not like you see the murder. You see him imagining, like, there's something weird about this going on. But, you know, his great guilt over that, because then he blames himself. But then he has to reconcile with the death of hundreds of thousands of people. And so, I don't know, to me, there was a lot of connective tissue there. And I thought it was interesting. And I didn't know how the guy grew up. Like, I didn't know what his trajectory was from, just like when he's being questioned. The movie bounces between these hearings from after everything goes down and the government is trying to revoke his security clearance. They're basically trying to get him away from anything with the government.
Railroad, the word you're looking for is,
yeah,
railroad.
Yeah, and so they're trying to connect him with the Communist Party, and the woman played by Florence Pugh was a member, and we see how he met her at a communist gathering.
Yeah.
And she was trying to kind of convince
him. A commie mixer.
Yeah, a mixer.
Yeah.
Here's a bowl of punch. Here's commie punch.
You know, we're joking about that, but there were a lot of men whose lives got screwed up because they tried to get laid.
Right.
Right.
Oh, well, I have to sign this and we'll go to bed? I'm signing anything. I'm 22 years old.
Having your life screwed up because you tried to get laid is a tale as old as time.
Yes,
that's true. That is not communist specific.
No.
So, you know, we follow her and then obviously his great regret. Like, it just didn't work out between those two, but they had that connection. And I don't know. To me, it was interesting. I didn't know about his life coming up. And so I didn't necessarily, if they would have just started at Los Alamos and the Trinity test, like, I would have felt like I didn't know much about Oppenheimer because I knew nothing
else. But I feel like there was a way that they could relate those pieces of information to you without spending an hour doing it.
Yeah.
Like,
I'm sure there is. Certainly.
Yeah, I was honestly more interested and appalled by them just dumping their kids off on somebody. That they're just like, you know what, raising these kids isn't really for me. You take them. And, like, the movie's kind of judgment-free on that. And, like, no, Looney Tunes.
But, I mean, yeah, it is. But they do kind of show both perspectives because Oppenheimer says, like, we're terrible people. Like, he says it flat out. I think the movie's telling you. And then who is the guy that he drops him off to? Is it his brother-in-law?
No, I think it's a friend.
It's a friend? Okay. Yeah. So they're
by
friends.
The way, how's that conversation? I need you to look after my kids for a while. Why? What are you doing? I'm going out to the desert for a special project for 2 years.
Yeah.
I thought you meant tonight.
Right.
But, you know, it just shows, and he's like, you're not like everyone else. You're obviously doing, I don't know exactly what you're doing, but I know it's important, like government work. So I don't necessarily think the movie is like, yeah, cool, that happens. But, like, they do explain, yeah, this is extremely unusual circumstance. You don't want them to spend another hour on that part either, right? So it's like,
I would have rather seen more about that.
Yeah.
To be honest. Like, you know, especially because I've seen lots of movies where the loose affiliations with communism comes back to haunt somebody, right? That's was not uncommon. Right. And so it's like, and maybe it's just an age thing. I've seen a lot of those movies to where I'm like, you can give me the bullet points. I got it. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I get, as soon as I see him at a party with a bunch of communists, I'm like, oh, yeah, this is Chekhov's communist. Well, like, just, I know what's happening.
They just did that with Lucy and Desi or whatever that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Remember, they just, yep, yeah, there's a big showdown with all that.
Right.
All those things in the 1950s.
Yeah. Right.
The country was just
the front with crazy. Woody Allen.
Yep.
Like, that's.
So just real quick to go over the cast, though. J. Robert Oppenheimer, Cillian Murphy. Again, I think he was phenomenal.
I think he's great.
There's going to, yeah, be Oscar buzz over his performance.
I love his resting physicist face.
Yeah, sure. I mean, but really, he does look like a man that is dealing with some stuff. Like, when you just see his face, and Nolan does a lot of close-ups, and some of them resemble some real footage of Oppenheimer, but when you see him just dealing with the inner turmoil about what he's done, I believed it. I thought he was always very believable, and when he was frustrated about something or upset, like, it didn't seem too big. You know, he never goes big. His performance is very intimate and
stoic.
Yeah, and it never, I don't know, it was very believable. And he's a great actor, but I think this may be one of his greatest performances.
I agree. One other thing about his performance.
Yeah.
Nolan shot this whole thing in IMAX.
Mm-hmm.
And if you see it, you should see it in IMAX.
Oh, I disagree.
Say, Tom's got an argument.
I don't think there's any reason to see this movie in IMAX. 40% of it takes place in a conference room. Like, there's one scene, I think, that benefits from IMAX.
The Trinity test.
Yeah, but the rest of it is just like, they're in boardrooms and conference hearings and, like, in shabby, rundown offices. I'm like, I don't get why people are like, you have to see this in IMAX.
Well, tell us, Paul. What do you think?
I just thought, for the Trinity test alone, it was worthwhile, which is the explosion when they first tested an atomic bomb in the desert in New Mexico. But also, there were some amazing vistas of that area when they weren't inside all looking at a blackboard, like we're on an episode of The Big Bang Theory. But here was the thing that I found interesting. IMAX is not made to be used for close-ups. It's for big, grand things.
Yeah.
Yet Nolan comes right in on Cillian Murphy all the time, and somehow that works.
Could you imagine the size of that camera right up in your face? Those things are huge.
And it makes a lot of noise, too.
Yeah. I saw it at the Alamo Draft House Theater, and I didn't go to Los Alamos.
This is why they say remember the Alamo.
Yeah.
Because he can't.
Yeah. So I saw it on the Big Show, which is their version. It's like the super screen, the mega screen, ultra, whatever. So it wasn't IMAX aspect ratio, but it's a big screen, right? And aside from the Trinity test, there's a lot of visuals of, like, reactions happening, and it's like it's kind of like what's going on in Oppenheimer's head. He's struggling with all these chain reactions and this looming threat that if they set off an atomic bomb, that it may never stop because there's oxygen in the air. And so since oxygen is flammable, they had this question of, if we set this off and this explosion happens, will it be a chain reaction that destroys the world? And so throughout his life, as he's dealing with, you know, can this be done? How can we do it? Should this be done? All that. There's these reactions going off. And right from the beginning, they start. And it's like it made the movie more exciting. This is a movie about physics and chemistry. And, you know, and so he puts these explosions in, these visuals. But I thought they were really effective in setting the tone of how anxiety-ridden this character would be and all these things going through his head. So anyway, but the visuals on the huge screen, they're like screensavers. You know, they're like these reactions, but, you know, at a micro zoomed in level, and the sound is really loud, and, you know, it's like vibrating your seat. So those things, I think, help too. And you have to remember also, IMAX is more than just the big screen. You know that when you're going to see an IMAX movie, there's a certain calibration of picture and sound and clarity. So I think maybe even more so than just the one scene, the whole movie, at least, you know, you'll be experiencing calibrated in a certain way. You know, because sometimes you go to theaters, like the AMC that closed by us recently.
Yeah.
I would go there, and sometimes the picture would be so bad and so faded. The sound would be like I was in a library watching a movie. Like, it would be so low, and it would ruin the experience. I saw a musical that way one time, and I'm like, well, this is...
I always wonder, it's digital.
Yeah.
You know, this is not like the old days where somebody had to calibrate the picture and calibrate the sound.
Or the film gets run down because of so many...
Because it went from it went from one theater to another and traveled.
Well,
and,
but the thing is with digital, this is just like at your house. Do you ever experience when you're watching a TV show and you turn the volume to the level you want and a commercial comes on, they're like, hey, no, 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 yes. You know, and you're like blows you away. Or you go and you put on a movie after you've been watching a TV show and you can't hear any of the talking, but the music and the sound effects are like, you know, and blow you away. And that wasn't Hans Zimmer. He didn't do this movie, but I know that sounded a lot like a Hans Zimmer. Ludwig Göransson, the score is another thing where I know you're not like a huge score guy, but to me this punched up the anxiety and the excitement of things that were going on, and I thought that his score was phenomenal. Did you notice throughout the film?
No, I thought the sound mix was rough. Like I had trouble. I thought it was getting the score was drowning out the dialogue a lot of times.
Yeah, but and you saw it in IMAX?
No.
Oh, you didn't. So, no. See, that's the problem, and I can't say for sure, but this is the problem, and why I've turned into this Alamo supporter is that, you know, it's a little further from me. It's a little more expensive unless you get their season pass, which is a phenomenal value. It's the price of one ticket, and you can see a movie every day for the month, so it's like no-brainer. But they just calibrate everything right. Not only is it a new theater in our area where the new 4K or 8K projectors, whatever they have, are so super crisp and the colors are amazing, the sound is loud, but it's all mixed properly. So when I was watching, I was thinking of you and you had made some comments and I'm like, yeah, there's some really loud sounds and then, you know, some quiet talking, but I could actually understand the whole thing. And I thought if you go to a theater that isn't properly calibrated, that ruins your whole experience, but it may not even be the film's fault if the theater's not calibrated properly.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how I'm supposed to judge that. Like, all I know is the experience
I
had.
That, but that's the thing. Is so it going to the Alamo now?
And I went to Chesterfield Galaxy, which is not like a rundown, theater.
Not run down, but they don't, you know, they don't have projectionists. And I know there's a thing about Alamo may also be going that way too, where it's a shame. But for now, they have projectionists. They have people that are calibrating.
Yeah.
Whereas at those theaters and most of them, it's the manager going and pressing, scheduling the hard drive to start at a time or whatever.
Yeah.
And so they don't check those things. So I'm just saying that it is a little, like for me, it's, I live by Tom and it is a little out of the way. It's, you know, further away and more expensive, but I'll tell you, ever since I've been going, the experience is phenomenal. So if you have an Alamo by you, like check it out. I know Joe goes there and he goes there every time now. And my other friends that I see movies with sometimes, Brad, you know.
The Brad Hyen rule.
I don't know if that will throw off the, the Brad Hyen rule. He goes almost exclusively to Alamo now. So everyone that's gone, it really is a different experience. So sound and picture are so important. And I know that like for a movie that has a lot of talking, it's not like you watch this at home and you're going to totally miss. Like this movie will work at home, but the experience, I tend to agree with Paul, where it's like if you see this on a huge screen, there just is something that you will not get. It just takes it to that next level where you're never going to get that at home, no matter how good your theater is, with these visuals, and especially the Trinity test, which is just phenomenal to see that happening. And all practical too. We haven't mentioned yet, but
they actually exploded an atomic bomb.
Don't think it was atomic, but somehow they created this explosion in a way, you know, using movie magic where they did a huge explosion. And Nolan said he did nothing. He says no CG. Now I'm guessing there's some touch up type things, but nothing is fully computer generated. They did not do a full scene.
It's
that
TNT
is,
plus fuel exploding.
Yeah.
And then he slowed that film down to make it even more dramatic.
Like So he really does everything in camera, which is something he's known for. When we saw behind the scenes of like The Dark Knight, which there's a lot of crazy stunts and things, you know, and he had a plane. Like when they were doing the Dark Knight Rises scene that has a plane, they took a plane, like a fuselage, up and held it by a helicopter, but they did that in the air. Like Nolan is such a practical guy, and it's phenomenal that, you know, we talked about Tom Cruise and Chris McQuarrie, you know, they're still doing this stuff too, but they're few and far between the guys that are still doing the practical stuff. But this movie, for those things, there's not a ton of action, but when you do see the explosions and the tests and everything, I mean, it looked phenomenal, and it's all practical. So Cillian Murphy's great, but just to go through the list real quick, Emily Blunt plays Kitty, which is his wife.
I was given nothing to do except one speech at the end.
Yeah.
Nothing up until that point.
It's
okay, honey, you have a good day at work.
And a very awkward reaction scene in a conference room.
Yeah.
Throughout the film, I mean, it did show the struggles of, like, these people probably should not have had kids, right? Like, these, you know, especially if they're going to just hand them off to their friends. And like, clearly, he was wrapped up in his work, which he obviously had some very important work to do. She didn't seem to be into it, right? I mean, she was having a tough time with the kids and was drinking. They show, I mean, clearly she was walking around with a bottle for most of the movie, showing that she was dealing with some issues and was coping with them with alcohol. I mean, like that one time he comes home, I think of when he says, I guess, was it after the Trinity test? It's when one of the things worked and she's like, oh my God, yeah, you know, let's go celebrate. And the baby's crying in the background and she's like totally ignoring it, like it's not even phasing her. This baby's just going on and on. He's like, shouldn't we check on him? And you know, she says, I've been checking on him all effing day, like he just won't stop. And she walks away with a bottle, which is a little heavy-handed, but like showing, I mean, she's just not in a good place
again. And this is a part of the story I did not need.
She does little things like that throughout the film just to show like what state of mind both those characters are in, their marriage, you know, and she's very good at it, but she isn't central to the bomb test. I mean, obviously she's behind the scenes, but you know, most people are there for the story of the bomb and the testing and getting the team together and all that stuff. So, but really good in the speech in the end.
You ever watch the old original Law and Orders, especially the seasons with Jerry Orbeck?
You mean the best ones?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes, I have.
You know nothing about the personal lives of those cops.
Yeah.
Or the prosecutors. They never go into that sort of stuff. You just see them doing the job that's in the title of the show.
What I liked is every once in a while, you'd get like this little glint, like this, they'd throw you this little stray line of dialogue.
Yeah.
Right? Where,
my daughter's drinking again.
Right.
And then right back to.
And yeah, it was, you know, but yeah, you're right. By and large, it was not a show about the cops, right? Yeah,
but you guys never watched Law and Order and Family?
No. Law and Order Babysitter.
Yeah.
I just, there are certain stories that are compelling on their own.
Yeah.
And you don't need to pad them with all of this sort of stuff. I'm not saying that this wasn't an important part of the real Robert Oppenheimer's life, but it doesn't have to be in the real Robert Oppenheimer movie.
Yeah. I struggle with that because I get what you're saying, because there are movies that we watch where I'm just like, move on to the thing. But I don't know, when there's someone as talented as Nolan, and I think he's a phenomenal writer, phenomenal director, you know, clearly, like you said, there's no one giving him notes, but when there's someone that good, it's like when Sorkin's writing and he's writing about, you know, and
yeah, but Sorkin's written some real dogs too.
Yeah,
I mean, nobody bats a thousand.
But sometimes,
and I'm not saying this is, I don't think this movie's a dog, but
no,
just because you've done one great thing, or even two, three, five great things, doesn't mean everything you do is going to be great.
Certainly, but I mean, there are films, though, that Sorkin has written that go long, and I was just going to say, like, they're not necessary, like, 100% necessary to the plot. You cut it, and you can still get pretty much the same idea. You can get the gist of it. But because he's such a good writer, I don't know, I find myself more drawn into his writing and enjoying it, even though it makes it go long, even though you don't have to have it. But I think Nolan's the same way, where I found these characters so interesting, and for me it worked. It humanized it in a way to where, I don't know, we see a lot of films where I ask, why should I care about these characters? Like, in this film, getting to know them and the history, to me at least, helped with humanizing them.
I think he was really just trying to not have a movie with a bunch of dudes in it.
Yes.
And because, you know, and this is the problem you have when you do historical dramas. Mm-hmm. It's like today it's diversity driven and representation, and like, and that's and that's fine. Like, I'm not complaining about that, but when you go back in time and tell a story, like a true historical story, like, that wasn't the way the world was constructed. And so if you're going to tell that story accurately, it's going to be, the cast is going to be 35 middle-aged white guys. And there's just no way around that. And I think this was his attempt to get around that.
True.
I
also, the women in his life that weren't going to be in these rooms and in the
who
army.
Are given nothing to do.
Yeah.
That's the problem.
Right.
I mean, you get Emily Blunt, you get Florence Pugh, and then you don't give them anything
to
do.
It's hard to say, though, because at that point in time, women weren't doing the thing. So they were doing what they were doing in real life, I think, but it was in the background of Oppenheimer's personal
in the background
going on.
Yes.
But, they weren't making the
the problem, right? Like, I'm not saying it's fair, but also when you go back and tell the story, like, how, you know, people today want and expect different things, and how do you give that to them when those people weren't allowed to participate at the same level?
Well, you know? I'll tell you, what comes to mind, what I really, really liked was, so first of all, to speak to the authenticity of the times and everything. And I, you know, Nolan is someone that is going to pay attention to those details. I went and watched a documentary. There's a lot of them, but there's a new one on Peacock that from 2023. And when they were going beat by beat and, you know, talking about stuff in Oppenheimer's life, and it was so close to the film,
yeah,
where I'm like, Nolan, this is, to me at least, not as a historian, not as an expert or someone that studies Oppenheimer, but watching the documentary and the real life stuff and the footage and then watching the film, I'm like, holy crap, this thing is very true to...
I'm not an expert on Robert Oppenheimer, but from what I can tell, like, this seems like one of the most straight historically accurate films that's come out of Hollywood. Like, normally they take wide liberties.
Right.
And this is probably, like, I think the only other movie I can think of that, from what I understand, is this historically accurate is Clint Eastwood's Flags of Our Fathers. Mm. Like, that, is, from what I understand, is like dead on.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
So, although I will say, Fat Man and Little Boy, which you mentioned,
yeah,
has all the same elements at the Los Alamos part of the story.
Right.
Yeah. So they did seem like they were following the historical beats very well. So I appreciate that, and especially as someone that doesn't know a lot about it. Like, you hate to watch a movie about something you don't know about. And I mean, like, a, I don't want to say fictional, but not a biopic, but, you know, it's about a historical event. And then you're like, oh, now I know this is how it happened. And then you talk to someone.
And then
someone,
you find out that it's
like,
not true.
Oh, yeah, none of that stuff happened. Right. Like, I hate that. So not knowing a lot about Oppenheimer and before the bomb and after the bomb, I'm glad to know that if you watch this film, well, sure, I'm sure things are dressed up a little bit, but the events that happened all seem, like, even the poison apple thing, that seems like a movie thing. I thought,
yeah,
he tried to poison his teacher. He got mad at him. You know, he treated him like crap or whatever. And even though he admired him, which he said later, I'm like, wow, that's a weird way to show it. But yeah. But he tried to.
But, you know, the people that you admire, if they treat you like
that. Oh, you take that as like.
That's much more hurtful.
Yeah.
Right.
So they must die.
Right.
But like, that story is a story that went around, and even Oppenheimer's estate or whatever was like, yeah, we kind of wish they didn't, you know, include that, but they're like, you're not going to tell Nolan what to do. But apparently that's a story about something that he did, and he, like, when I was watching it, I was like, no way, that's a total weird movie thing to, like, oh my god. And it was anxiety inducing and stressful. Like, how is he going to get out of this? How is he going to do it without giving away
right
what he had done? And Niels Bohr, played by Kenneth Branagh, because legally Nolan has to have Kenneth Branagh in a movie. That's just the law. But he does a great job in this. And he plays Niels Bohr, and he's there giving a, what would you call that, a symposium?
Like a lecture.
A lecture, yeah, on whatever, well, physics probably, or chemistry. And afterwards, he's meeting with the teacher that Oppenheimer had put arsenic, was it arsenic? Cyanide.
Yeah.
Something cyanide. I don't know if that's arsenic. Potassium cyanide into an apple. He injected it in after he treated him badly or whatnot. And he comes back, and Niels Bohr is like, you know, juggling the apple, polishing it up. And he definitely doesn't want to poison Niels Bohr. He didn't do anything to him. And so he ends up saying wormhole. And throws it away in the trash real quick. But that was another one where the score punctuates all these little moments. I think they did a really good job of making me feel anxious. I was anxious this whole time with what was going on, because we know how it's going to go, but as they're flashing back and they're working on this atomic project, you know, they don't know, right? Like, they don't know if it's going to work. They don't know if they're going to blow up the world, kill themselves, and they don't know exactly what it's going to be used for. I mean, what we're led to believe is that Oppenheimer thinks they're using this to deter war, to threaten war, and then they end up,
and I'm sorry, that's dumb. Yeah. when he's like, but I mean, he can be dumb,
yeah,
right? Like, you can be really smart in one area and really dumb
right
in another.
Nice
but when he's like, you need to tell the Japanese, they're not gonna believe you.
Yeah.
If you're like, hey, we've got this really big bomb that's never existed before, and if you do something, like,
they could send them the Trinity test, right? Like, there's footage of how destructive, that's our small little
okay
test.
But if the country that in other parts of the world is best known for its movie making capabilities sends you a film, like, you know what I mean?
True.
You know, I just think that you're going to, if you're the Japanese, you're going to bend over backwards to be like, they are totally bluffing here. I think.
So you
invite him over for a weekend at the lake.
Yeah.
Right.
And then all of a sudden the water disappears.
Right. Yeah.
Well,
and to the point of the Japanese, like, I do find it frustrating that, like, there is really no part of the story that truly explores the impact that that had in Japan.
Has there ever been a movie about how Japan came back after Hiroshima and Nagasaki? How they rebuilt the country and, you know, went on to be a leader in several different industries just a couple of decades later? I've never seen anything like that.
Like an American made, like a...
Yeah.
There might be some documentaries. There's a really good one, I think, called like White Heart, Black Sun, something like that. And it's... And but it's more focused on what happened in Hiroshima, and they're interviewing like actual survivors talking about living through the blast and like and the ramifications it had on it. I watched it on HBO years ago, so I don't know if it's living somewhere secretly on Max, but
who knows?
Yeah, but
you have to go to Zaslav's house, you have to leave a tip under the door, secret knock.
But that's a fascinating and just gut-wrenching documentary. But in terms of their comeback, I don't know, and it's probably hard to construct a narrative around how this entire country kind of pulls it back together after something like that. But
yeah, but I can't think of any feature that goes into, like, there's no famous one. Oh, yeah, that starred whoever. Like, I don't know.
Yeah.
But the documentary, the Oppenheimer documentary, does go into that, and you hear from survivors and family members and the destruction and seeing death and bodies floating, bodies in the streets and bodies floating in the water and just all the terrible ramifications. But I get what you're saying because I hear some of those complaints. But this was a story about Oppenheimer dealing with
But if he's dealing with the aftermath, then maybe you could have a passing reference to the math.
Well, but he does say that he killed hundreds of thousands of people. Like,
yeah, it's very abstract. It's not tactile like a lot of the other things in this movie. It's very much removed and presented as an abstract concept.
Sure.
It's presented as numbers. It's not presented as
and
human
his and his reaction, which I mean, yes, obviously,
but it still kind of ends up I feel like the end result is all these hundreds of thousands and eventually millions of people died because of this, and like look how sad it made this white guy. Right, like that's kind of the takeaway of the film. And I honestly don't think that's what Nolan's trying to do. But by not addressing, even when he shows the effects of the nuclear blast, right, it's in Oppenheimer's head and you see it happening to a white person. Like that's not cool.
The argument's valid. Yeah. I can see what you mean. I guess I don't know. I mean,
and I think if there's anything we learned from Barbie the week before, it's okay to like something, and even if there's something else that's problematic about it, you can still enjoy that thing. No one's saying because this one thing happened, you can't love Barbie anymore, or as the doll specifically. And so it's like, this can still be a good movie, but that maybe it dropped the ball on that part.
Yeah, I don't know how you tastefully show that without then... I just think damned if you do, damned if you don't. If they showed the aftermath, what are you going to put makeup on a bunch of Japanese people and make it horrendous? I mean, it happened. I'm not saying like you don't want to hide it, but they do tell you it happened. But I just don't know. Showing it, I just think that you're going to open up a whole nother can of worms. And then I think Japan's going to be offended and people are going to be offended. I just don't know. I don't know.
I feel like there's a way to do it, especially with someone as talented as Nolan. Like if there's anyone who can do it. But it just feels like the silence on that issue is deafening.
Okay, fair enough. What was really powerful was Cillian Murphy's performance, and like we've touched on before, but just dealing with the weight of his actions. I can't imagine being one person, like if you did something, like he, again, being torn up about his girlfriend who died and was ultimately because of him connecting the dots, and that's one person. And then you see that he's responsible for the death of hundreds of thousands, and eventually millions, and the weight of that. And how do you live with yourself? How do you sleep? And we see him being haunted by his actions, and he's seeing death and destruction, and he's anxious and stressed out about things. And I thought that was really interesting because I know that we all get stressed out by things and even little tiny things. And I just don't know how you even go on.
The last time I killed a couple hundred thousand people, I couldn't sleep for like a week.
just a week.
I figured they had it coming.
Strong constitution.
Those hundreds of thousands of people I killed, I was like, well.
Yeah.
Wow.
He was in a position where he didn't really have a choice, right? Like, it is one of those times when, to me, it's like, normally these questions are very abstract, but he really was in a position where the fate of the world hung in the balance.
Like, I mean, meanwhile, I mean, we didn't mention it, but if you know the history, Hitler was working on an atomic bomb.
Yeah, and that's a real thing. And
wait,
and
turns out not so much.
Yeah,
they were not even close.
Yeah,
but they were. But if he said no, and no one else could crack it, I mean,
I'm not saying he should say no.
Right,
it's just again, they make it seem like Hitler's going to have a bomb Tuesday. We have the weekend. Let's get this done. Right.
But also, you can't sit around and wait for someone to crack it over there. Like, we find out, we now know he wasn't as close.
Yeah, I understand.
But if you're making those decisions, and the same thing happens with all the generals and all the decision makers in Washington, all the way up the ladder, how do you make these choices when the fate of the world hangs? And it's like, you can't rest.
And
you can't.
Also, you know, at the end of the day, it's his job to keep Americans alive.
Yeah.
Right. Like, I mean, I know that's callous, but it's a war. And, you know how many people they were expecting to die if they staged an invasion of Japan. Like, I sent Kevin an article about it. Like, they made so many Purple Hearts for the impending invasion of Japan that never occurred that they're still handing out those Purple Hearts to this day.
From 1945?
Yes.
It's insane. What was the number?
It was like they have like 100, and they made like 500,000 Purple Hearts, and we still have like 120,000 left.
Wow.
So, I mean, that's
insane. Like, so it's like, so he killed a lot of people. He kept a lot of Americans alive. Now, he killed a lot of civilian women, children. He wasn't, he wasn't killing soldiers.
Yeah.
So, I mean, like, I'm not trying to be like, so what you going to do?
But that's all the question. He killed, right?
So, right.
Like,
the thing he invented killed.
Exactly.
No, nobody goes around saying, we don't get a biopic about Smith and or Wesson. Mm-hmm. How many people I've killed, right?
Yeah, right.
Like, it's, yeah.
But I get it that he has that moral
quandary,
thank you, during and after. At the beginning, though, I don't think he was thinking about that sort of stuff.
No.
I think he was thinking about...
It was a fun problem to solve.
This is a scientific problem that I have the knowledge, and I have friends who have the knowledge, and we can all get together, and we can solve this thing.
Yeah.
And then halfway or three-quarters of the way through it, they started thinking, wait a second, if you actually use this...
Right.
Yeah. Well, I mean, because Matt Damon...
It's like in Real Genius.
You end up with all that popcorn.
Yeah. But in Real Genius, they have that moment where they're like, well, if you're inventing this laser, what possible purpose could it serve?
Yeah.
And like, and Chris Knight is like, well, I mean, it's not my job to figure out a reason for it. Like, they just said, make the thing and I make the thing. And we're like, but they already have a reason for it.
Yeah.
Right. Like,
But I mean, that's why I think also the beginning part is important as, yes, it may be a little bit drawn out, but it's, I think, to show that Oppenheimer was doing his science stuff. He wasn't, it's not like this movie started, Oppenheimer's like, I'm going to create the greatest weapon that ever existed. It's like he's doing experiments and he's trying to figure things out. And then the war happens and they hear that Hitler's doing this stuff and they're like, whoa.
Well, and they had all these theories that nobody had the money to actually test. And so, I mean, you hear him, what do they say? They spent like $1 billion on this? And
$2 billion.
Okay.
So at one point he says, I spent $1 billion on this and I have nothing. That's Matt Damon.
Oh, right.
That's my Matt Damon. Pretty good.
In the end.
I saw one review said that they hired Matt Damon to play Matt Damon, but grumpy.
Yeah. I mean, it's not a far stretch from what you imagine Matt Damon. He's good, but it's like he's not exactly putting on a...
But also that's $2 billion. $1942, right? Like that's not nothing.
Yep.
Yeah. But so Robert Downey Jr. is the other one that's going to be getting Oscar buzz as Louis Strauss. And I do think it's interesting how they show like their relationship when they met, and you see that, they're both two Jewish men, and Oppenheimer is embracing that he's Jewish. And, Strauss is like, it's Strauss, not Strauss. He's trying to cover it up. And it shows like, I think right there is just like that little line is like the duality of these two guys, like how, Strauss is going to be doing some underhanded stuff. He's trying to hide who he really is, and coming to find out he's doing a lot of stuff, pulling strings behind the scenes that, will end up causing the demise of Oppenheimer, at least of his work and his clearance and all that. Robert Downey Jr. gets to act again like he used to do. He's not just Robert Downey Jr.
Right.
Like if you haven't seen Chaplin from, I think that was 1992.
Yeah.
Attenborough directed that, and that's a phenomenal film, and it's just great. I think one of his best performances, but he gets to do a great performance here. Alden, Iron Rick, the Han Solo, the new Han Solo. I can't ever.
Oh, I can never say.
You know, Alden Iron Rick. Jason Clark is one of the guys that's interviewing him, who's really good. Tony Goldwyn is in it. We talked about him. He showed up on that plane movie. Remember, he was the damage control.
Am I crazy? Did David Strathairn pop up in like a scene of this movie and like say practically nothing?
I could have swore
I saw him in one of those conference scenes.
Yeah, I didn't. I don't
remember. And I wondered if it was a cute nod because he's played Oppenheimer.
Oh, I think twice. I didn't notice.
I didn't notice him.
But yeah. James Darcy, Kenneth Branagh, just going through some of the names that I recognize here. But then, you know, you have people like Rami Malek that show up for a second. Alex Wolff is plays Luis Alvarez, who's like one of his students that starts working with him. Josh Hartnett is another professor at the university. Who else is in this?
Gary Oldman is Harry Truman.
Well, yeah, Gary Oldman pops up at the end as Harry S. Truman. But like you said, Florence Pugh.
He's on a quest to play every historical figure who was ever involved in World War II.
Yeah, no kidding. Florence Pugh played Gene Tatlock, was the name of his, the person he was had an affair with that ended up dying under these kind of mysterious circumstances that seemed to be, they're alluding to, were government influenced. Matthew Modine is in it. Matt Damon playing Leslie Groves, who plays him in the movie you watched?
Paul Newman.
That's Paul.
And by the way, it's a great performance.
Okay.
Does he have a bad performance?
Jack Quaid is in this movie as Richard Feynman. Benny Safdie's in this. He plays Edward Teller, the grumpy guy in the back who was always like very matter of fact about working on this stuff. But like the list just goes on and on and on. Like this is one of the most stacked casts where every scene someone would pop up that I didn't know was in this movie, and I'd be like,
which I think in a movie like this, it's important to stack the cast with recognizable faces.
So you can differentiate.
There's
all
so
these
many
characters
are throwing at you, and that it's a way to be like, even if you can't remember the name, you're like, Matt Damon. Okay, got it.
Yeah, exactly. Well, Casey Affleck plays Boris Pasch, who was like the guy that ended up kind of bringing down Oppenheimer, who was really against him. But, you know, again, we find out that there's stuff going on with Strauss in the background. David Dalmatian, I can't ever remember his name, but he was in The Dark Knight as the police officer that like was the Joker brainwashed into doing whatever. But anyway, but he was in that. Nolan kind of gave him his start, and he plays, let's see, what's his character name in this one? There are a lot of characters, so it's hard to keep track of all of them. He's the guy that basically Strauss was feeding him the FBI file on Oppenheimer so that he could put in a report about why he's a communist. But
and Strauss is doing all this basically because he hurt his feelings.
Yeah. He embarrassed him about something that he wanted to do. They keep flashing back to this moment where Oppenheimer's kind of joking around in one of these hearings, and Strauss wants to do something, and he cracks wise, and people are laughing. And so, basically he had this ulterior motive to take out Oppenheimer this whole time, and then eventually throughout the film, we see he's running for what is the position?
He's nominated
the cabinet
for Secretary of Commerce.
Yeah, under Eisenhower. Yeah.
Okay, so he's trying to run for that, and the whole thing is like him and Iron Rick, or his like one of his staffers. He thinks he's got it in the bag, but they have to go through these hearings, which they say are formalities. They say no one since 1920 whatever has been denied a post on one of these appointments. So they said this is a formality, but some of the hearings have him sweating, and they start hearing from scientists, and all the scientists know that he railroaded Oppenheimer. So they're, giving some testimony, which isn't looking too good. This whole time he's like, I thought you said I had it in the bag. And so those moments I thought were interesting because they do introduce a little bit of that, I'd call it courtroom drama, but it's not really. But, those hearings, I think.
Well, because they even keep saying, like, he's like, well, what about this? What about that? And they're like, this isn't a trial.
Which,
like, we don't have to do any of those things. It's not a trial.
Which was a nice parallel to the Oppenheimer hearing.
Yeah.
Or hearings or whatever they want to call it, to revoke his security clearance, because you keep seeing these mirror images. So as much as Strauss screwed over Oppenheimer, and his friends kind of end up doing the same thing to him because they're like, this isn't a trial.
Right.
That's the exact same line they wrote in for that scene when Oppenheimer and his lawyer or his counsel or whatever were trying to say things, and they're like, that doesn't apply here. This isn't a courtroom. This is just a hearing. Like, they're acting like, oh, we're just getting this on the record and whatever, but they're trying to put all this stuff on Front Street. They're like, these notes will be publicly accessible or whatever. They're on the record, and it's a lot of evidence or a lot of testimony from people that are about that he may be a communist, and it's basically going to smear his good name so that the scientific community won't work with him. You know, I mean, at this time, obviously, anyone who's suspected of being a communist, it would end them. And so by doing that, and that's the part, I don't think I got a chance to say it, but I think that is the part that Emily Blunt as his wife, Kitty, really excels in.
Yeah, she has one good speech.
No, but throughout the film, though, and what from what I understand with the way that Oppenheimer kind of became a shell of himself because he was dealing with all this the horrible, horrific aftermath of what he had created, was that Oppenheimer wasn't fighting these people that were trying to take him down. He wasn't fighting all these people that Strauss, you know, lined up to you know, get him out of there. And so she has lines throughout the movie where it's like, why don't you fight? Why don't you fight for us? They are trying to destroy you and you're just sitting there. And I don't know, I thought that made for some compelling scenes between the two of them, because I think that is how Oppenheimer was. He was like, it was kind of like that, I deserve this. You know, yeah. Like I killed so many people. I created this whole thing. And yeah, I'm just going to take this. And she's like, no, you didn't. You were doing your job. And now they're going to take away everything from us and all the great things. Like, you're a hero. Like, a lot of people say he's a war hero. He's, you know, he saved the world, essentially. He saved the country. And now he's being treated like crap.
Well, there's been this shift in public perception, right? Like, at first he's a hero, where, you know, you see this in the scene where, like, he's given that speech after the bomb works and they're very excited. And then there's this period where he kind of sees what it did. And then the country kind of shifts because they think he's a communist. And then people turn on McCarthy and it shifts back. Mm. And that's where Strauss gets hung up, right? Is that he did something that at one moment in time was very popular. And then 5-10 years later, not so much.
Yeah, those Oppenheimer hearings were 9 years after the bomb. Yeah. And America didn't have quite the short attention span it does now.
Yeah.
But over 9 years, you know, they got into other stuff.
Yeah. And the Oppenheimer hearings weren't these big public things, right? Like they were, it was in this little tiny conference room, and all it revolved around was, I mean, he was never going to go to jail. He wasn't going to, you know, he was in no trouble per se.
It was just his security clearance.
It was just his security clearance.
Which would essentially end his work.
Right. So it's like, on the one hand, they could say, well, this is no big deal. It's just a security clearance, so it doesn't have to be a trial. We don't have to have the same burden of proof. And, you know, you're not really in trouble. You're just not going to have this thing anymore. Oh, but by the way, this thing is the entirety of your career and what it's based on, and you can never work in this field again at this level. But, you know, so it is a very punishing thing if he were to lose it.
Yeah.
But they can also distance it and say, well, we're not saying he's a bad guy. We're just saying better safe than sorry because, you know, we love America.
All right, let me ask you this. I thought that Robert Downey Jr. was very, very good as Strauss.
Strauss.
Did we need his story? If he's not in this movie, if we don't have the Strauss character in this movie, how does it change?
Well, it's a very different movie, right? Because Strauss is what gives the movie, I know this is going to sound really dumb considering we're talking about the building of an atomic bomb, but it's what gives the movie stakes from a personal standpoint, right? Like it's this is what's endangering Oppenheimer's career, and then you get the Strauss getting his comeuppance, right? Like this is the kind of emotional narrative that this movie's constructed.
But I think the communist stuff would have come back to haunt him without Strauss being the guy with the fork in the side pushing it along. I think that hearing in 1954 happens with or without Strauss.
But I guess, you know, being historically accurate, I think Nolan wanted to tell the story of how he got railroaded and Strauss was the guy doing it. And so I do think that it gave a compelling emotional stakes, but also I think it's historically important also to show you how. There's a line in the movie, and I can't remember exactly who it is that Oppenheimer is speaking with, but when he's getting the team together, you know, because there's a getting the team together type thing with all the scientists and all the students and people from all over, and he tells one of them, these physicists, they don't want to work for the government. They're doing research. They're trying to write papers and advance science and all that stuff. And Oppenheimer becomes the figurehead and is trying to enlist them. And he's like, why are we doing this? And they're like, aren't you worried? You have these communist ties. They're going to use that against you and all this. And he's like, no, they're going to, you know, they need us. And they're like, until they don't.
Right.
And which I think is very important because it shows how people are chewed up and spat out. They're used for as long as they're useful, and then they'll turn their back on you. And he saved the entire country and maybe the entire world.
Yeah.
And then you have these guys in the government trying to take away his clearance and smear his name. And it's like, that's the kind of treatment he gets as a war hero, and who Nolan refers to, and I think even in the film, as the most important person to ever live. And here they are 9 years later trying to take away his security clearance, and they know it's BS. They know they're planting evidence, basically, against him. And so I think that's an important story to tell.
I think it's important for especially younger people to see it, because I think there's this notion that, like, well, we used to be better.
And it's
back in the good old days.
Yeah, and it's like,
yeah, make America great again.
Right.
I saw this
in the good old days where we all had our own drinking fountains. Yeah.
I saw this with my grandma, and then afterwards we talked. She goes, you know, everyone used to refer to the good old days and look at under the constant threat of nuclear war and all that stuff going on. It's just funny. She mentioned the same thing, like the good old days, quote unquote.
Yeah. Yeah.
David Dastmalchian is William Borden is the character he plays. And he's the guy that Strauss fed him the FBI file. And the whole time, like, how would he get this file? Why would he have this FBI file? And Strauss was handing people the evidence to implicate him. Now, one of the other scenes I really like that follows throughout the film and is kind of like you said, like the reveal that Nolan tries to build throughout it, is there's a meeting with Einstein and Oppenheimer, and Strauss is in the background. And he doesn't know what Oppenheimer says to Einstein, but you see this moment from far away, and the movie bounces back and forth. I don't know if we mentioned it, but the black and white stuff is from Strauss's perspective, and the color stuff is from Oppenheimer's perspective. So Nolan doesn't use black and white and color for passage of time. Like Memento, he uses it where Guy Pearce is like trying to remember things, and then it's present time, then it cuts back to the past, and it's black and white. So this is kind of a different narrative from perspective, which I thought was interesting. But we first see Strauss sees the Oppenheimer-Einstein conversation, and we see this replay over and over again. And when Einstein leaves and starts walking towards Strauss, he ignores him. He doesn't even look at him. And so this is another time where Strauss says, oh, that Oppenheimer, he has something out for me. He's turned Einstein against me, all this stuff the whole time. And then I really like it with Eigenreich, whatever, his staffer says, like, what if they didn't even mention you? What if it wasn't even about you? Like, I think that shows how we can get so wrapped up in our own lives and how we're the main character of our story and we're so self-important.
And insecure.
What are they saying about me? I mean, that's something that everyone does. Like, it happens all throughout real life is like, oh, I bet they're saying something about me, or oh, I bet whatever.
And I tell my kids all the time,
yeah,
you wouldn't be worried about what people are saying about you if you realized how seldom they did.
Exactly.
That's great.
And so I really like how that, you know, this is just a classic story of hubris of Strauss and having this, oh, he's got it out for me. He's got, you know, he's going to try to turn, he turned Einstein against me and all that. And really, it's a really good conversation when we actually end up seeing it. So in the beginning, before the bomb, before all that stuff, Oppenheimer came to Einstein with all these formulas that the Benny Safdie character, again, it's hard to keep track of all the names.
For sure. But,
you know, movie people know Benny Safdie. He plays the guy that was, I mean, they were all important, but he did the mathematics on the problem of if we have this atomic explosion, will the air catch on fire? Will the oxygen ignite?
Will it set off a chain reaction that never stops?
Yeah.
And so destroy the planet.
All the physicists are gathered around like, oh my God, this is huge. This is crazy. Like, is this really going to happen? And so Oppenheimer brings the formula to Einstein. He says, can you take a look at this? Can you run the numbers? Because we think, you know, whoever figured this out, and we think that it could possibly end the world. And so he comes.
I love Einstein. I love Einstein here where he's like, I'm not really good at math.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not a math guy.
Yeah.
Well, and I think that also it's kind of interesting because Einstein wasn't a part of this project because they thought that he was past his prime. There's that scene earlier, which they also mentioned in the documentary or something I watched touched on it. But, you know, Einstein was one of the greatest mathematicians ever. And when they ask, maybe Oppenheimer or someone asks him, why aren't we getting Einstein? He's like, he's the greatest mind of our time. And he goes, no, he was the greatest mind of his time. Like his time has passed. He's not capable of doing this stuff we need to do.
Yeah.
And so, you know, they bring him this stuff and he's kind of like, yeah, I'm not really involved in this. And, you know, you guys, not so in so many words, but, you know, yeah, this isn't really my strong suit. That conversation where by the lake where his hat blows away and Strauss is walking towards him, it ends up, he basically says, you know, do you remember when I gave you this formula. And he's, Einstein's like, yeah, of course I remember that. And he's like, I asked you if we would set off a chain reaction, it would destroy the world. And I think it ends up being like the last line of the movie. And he's like, I believe we did.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, so not in a, obviously it's in a metaphorical sense, but right. Like, yeah, we really did, because we created a nuclear bomb and it may not have destroyed the world in a chain reaction of particles exploding and the world ending, but you know, now we have nuclear war. So I thought that was a really cool scene, the way that it played out in different angles and how it drives Strauss to kind of drives him crazy against Oppenheimer, and then to end up he wasn't even thinking about him, and Einstein was just like distraught with the implications of what was going on and how the world essentially was, you know, ending, not in a literal sense, but how now we're
but how this, it easily could
yeah constant yeah. threat of nuclear war. And now people, I mean, go forward, obviously the Trinity test was amazing. I don't know if you guys have anything else to touch on that, but that scene was
that scene was great.
Fantastic. And then obviously they end up doing what they do, they drop the bombs. He has a tense meeting with Truman, and I heard this was the fictionalized part. You know, this is one of those moments where you're like, where he hands him the thing, he's like, I've got blood on my hands, and Truman hands him
I read an article that said that there's been several different descriptions of this meeting, and but this is one of them. Like, this is that, like, Truman talked about it in his biography or autobiography, and that. And
I
that,
just heard the handkerchief thing was a dramatization.
What I read was that they're not sure.
Okay.
That, like, there are, that I think that the question is it maybe puffery by Truman after the fact?
Okay. Yeah.
But I think Truman did call him a crybaby, but not, or he said, I don't want this guy in my office crying or something like that. But I don't think he said it when Oppenheimer was in earshot. But he had no patience for the level of pussitude.
Well, because, like,
Oppenheimer was displaying, because
I mean, yeah, Truman's taking credit and he's like, I just ended this war and I just saved the country and all this stuff, and then Oppenheimer's coming in with the and also it's probably a little bit of insecurity on Truman's part, because, you know, Oppenheimer created this thing they used, but then Truman had to make this call. And I mean,
well,
you know
you need the guy with the PhD to build it, and you need the guy that barely graduated high school to deploy it,
right,
that's
and then take full credit for it. You didn't drop the bomb. Yeah, I dropped the bomb.
But he's right. You know, I mean,
but that's also, I feel like, a little bit of chest puffing too, where, like, if Truman doesn't act that way, he's going to have to actually reflect on what he did, right? Because he did kill hundreds. I mean, he's saying, oh, I saved hundreds of thousands. But if he doesn't say that, he's going to think, well, I killed hundreds of thousands.
And I think technically the bombardier in the Enola Gay dropped the bomb.
Yeah. Of course, if he had chose not to, what would that life have looked
yeah.
like?
Yeah,
right. And that is why I think this film is
fail safe.
Yeah, that's such a good movie.
With Slim Pickens riding the bomb down.
I think that's
well. That's Strangelove.
That's Strangelove.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Fail safe is like the serious version of Strangelove.
Right.
Yeah.
With Henry Fonda.
Yeah,
and Larry Hagman,
Walter Matthau, and
I think the Benny Safdie character, and, you know, he wears those glasses when they're doing the Trinity test. I think that the main character, maybe it's the Peter Sells character, is based on that real life person or something. I read there's some connection between that character and why you get, like, those glasses, goggles, which are, I think, kind of similar to the Strangelove glasses that you always, I don't know. There's a connection there, but I didn't read enough into it.
I will say this about Oppenheimer. I can't think of, aside from The Imitation Game, a movie that was about scientists trying to solve something. Okay, I'll give you Hidden Figures.
Hidden Figures
is probably up there as well.
Yeah.
But if you take out anything to do with space, because The Martian, I guess you
could throw
in there too.
Okay, because I was going to say Apollo 13.
Yeah, but if you take out anything to do with space,
okay,
is there any other movie about science? Like there's
a
no
discovery.
There's not, well, we're gonna get rid of smallpox. We're going to get rid of, there's no Jonas Salk popular movie or any of that.
This is not one that is on the level of those other ones you mentioned, but there's one that Katie and I watched with Claire Danes about a person that was researching autism, and she was autistic, and she invented a lot of
The Temple Grandeur.
The Temple Grandeur.
Grandeur, HBO movie. That's a good movie.
It was really good, but it's an HBO movie, and I don't think a lot of people have seen it, but that had a lot of science. It wasn't physical reactions, but it's a science of, I think that's maybe the closest that I can think of that was really good that wasn't space related. But there aren't many.
Because before I went to see this, I was thinking about that on the drive to the movie theater, and I thought, who is this movie for? I mean, I understand it got caught up in the Barbenheimer hype and all that. But I said to myself, who's going to go see a movie about scientists, as Tom said, sitting around and talking?
Yeah.
But, man, a lot of people did.
I mean, it's a huge number. I'm shocked at how many people have gone to see this.
It opened to, like, 70 million? Like, Barbie did 120?
I thought it was 80.
Yeah, I thought it was closer to 80.
I thought I read 80,
I mean, and because Nolan is one of the last filmmakers that opens a movie based on name alone. Doesn't matter what it's about. You know, you see the new Christopher Nolan movie. Tenet only got buried because it was during COVID and people weren't going to theaters. But because you could point to Tenet, and Tenet's his lowest critical rating and the box office wasn't great. But we were in very weird
times.
It was
very weird times. Tenet, I liked Tenet. I thought Tenet was a lot of fun.
I love Tenet. I think it got just the whole situation because he was trying to get people to go to theaters during COVID and the whole politicized nature of it.
Well, and it was it was kind of over, but not really. And I think they thought this would be enough to get people back, and it wasn't.
And people were mad because it was clear that it wasn't completely over, and people were still being cautious. Yeah. And he's like, nope, literally, this movie in theaters. So he caught a lot of guff because of that, and rightfully so. I get the argument, but the point is, Tenet is a weird situation. That's an asterisk because it's real. But other than that, you know, Nolan opens a movie. It doesn't matter if it's about scientists, and people showed up for it. Did you see what the second week? I heard the second week did really well. Let me see if I can find the – I have the Friday and its second week it did 13.4 million. So this movie's still making a ton. Barbie did 29 million on Friday. Oppenheimer did 13.4 million. So that's no slouch.
No,
for
absolutely.
A second week.
Especially for a very serious, somber film.
Three-hour science –
That's a tough sell.
That's what I wondered about. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But anyway, so yeah, there's a really – so they drop the bombs, that Truman situation happens, and really it's about Oppenheimer dealing with all this stuff, meanwhile cutting back and forth with the hearings, both hearings, the Strauss and the Oppenheimer hearings, and then come to find out that Strauss does not get placed. So he's the first one in whatever it was, 30, 40, whatever.
Which is very unusual. Normally, like
– if the president picks you
– I mean – both parties, even today,
yeah.
as ugly as it is, both parties are typically like
they play kind
the of- the president deserves the cabinet of his choice,
yeah.
right? Like it's like if that's who he wants to be Secretary of State, then that's probably who it should be. Like they, you know, they don't get they tend to rubber stamp that unless
you really have to do something to you know to make yourself not. Land on that cabinet.
It's, for sure.
I was just trying to look up real quick if I had the weekend projection.
While you do that, you know, one of the things that'll be interesting, because I think Robert Downey Jr. will probably win an Oscar for this movie, especially because he'll be in the supporting category.
Okay.
And so he's a big actor, a big name with a long career. Hollywood loves him. If he gets the nomination, I don't see how he does not win.
With a solid performance. Like
absolutely.
Can't, this isn't necessarily a gimme.
No, not at all. But at the same time, like in another set of circumstances with a different actor, I don't know that it's a foregone conclusion, but he's checking all the boxes, right? So if he wins this Oscar, he will be, to the best of my knowledge, the first SNL cast member to win an Oscar.
Wow.
Yeah. Like that's no, like I believe he was the first ever nominated. People forget that he was on SNL, but
a horrible season.
Horrible. Yes. Maybe the worst. I mean, it's like between that and the
Gilbert Gottfried year.
Yeah. I was going to say Charles Rocket, but same season. Yeah, yeah. With when Jean Dumont took over. Right. Yeah.
Tina Fey has a Tony and Golden. I guess she had never gotten an Oscar though. She's got a lot of awards, but I guess not a...
Yeah, I'm sure she's got an Emmy.
She's an Emmy and a Tony.
And a Tony, but...
But she's not an EGOT.
Yeah. Okay. And so, yeah, so if he would be the first SNL cast member to win an Oscar.
Interesting, because, you know, there's so many comedians that have taken the serious route in their later years and
I mean, Dan Aykroyd was nominated for... Was he nominated for, I think, Best Supporting for Driving Miss Daisy?
Maybe.
Because he had a real good shot, and Bill Murray's been nominated a couple times.
Right, I'm so surprised, and especially you think like Bill Murray might win for a Wes Anderson movie or something like that's really interesting to think about that it hasn't happened because there's been so many great actors to come out of SNL. Yeah. I mean, even Sandler's put in great performances.
Yeah.
Like Punch Drunk Love. Sandler's done some serious stuff besides
Uncut
goofy
Gems.
Stuff. Yeah. Uncut Gems. Yeah, there's the other one. So
Rob Schneider.
Deuce. Oh, of course. Yeah. Deuce Bigelow. He was just
How
nominated.
About this? Has there been anybody who played a superhero? Not counting Heath Ledger, who was the villain in a superhero movie. Has anybody who played a superhero gone on to win an Oscar?
Not for that role, but just
for
gone
anything.
On to.
Hmm.
An Oscar.
Did Michael Keaton get one for Birdman?
Oh, that's a good question.
Did he win the Oscar? I know the movie.
The movie
Best
did.
Picture.
Yeah.
Okay, you'll have to look that up. So box office, we'll jump around here for a second. So Barbie in its second week, $88.6 million. Barbie had the highest opening of the year, the highest opening ever for a female director, and in its second weekend only took a 45% drop.
Yeah, and by the way, any other movie, 45% drop off, that thing's dead.
45% drop off with $88.6 million this weekend. Oppenheimer in its second weekend, $50.8 million, a 38% drop from a huge opening as well.
Wow.
Haunted Mansion opened to $28.8 million, so half of Oppenheimer in its second week. Mission Impossible in its third week, is it? $13.3 million, which is a 31% drop. So, I mean, yeah, it's dropped quite a bit.
I think it's the fourth weekend.
Oh, is it its fourth?
I think there were 2 weeks between Mission Impossible and Oppenheimer Barbie.
So, I mean, yeah, so
what's coming up soon that will knock these two off the top?
The Ninja Turtles movies next weekend are just going to be huge because that's going to be a nostalgia, kids, all that stuff. If Barbie had $88.6 million, I'm trying to think, what would it do? If it dropped another half, let's say $40 million, would Ninja Turtles open higher than $40-$50 million? It's a kids movie. It's a big property. I think it probably will. I think Ninja Turtles will be number one.
Hmm. Michael Keaton did not win. He was nominated for an Oscar and won the Golden Globe, but he did not win for Birdman.
I didn't think he did. But yeah, so that's really interesting trivia. I've never seen. Can you watch Robert Downey Jr. on SNL? Are those clips?
All the seasons are out there.
Yeah, I think
so. Oh, all seasons are out?
Yeah.
Okay.
All on Peacock?
I guess.
I thought there were some they buried in those foul years that they didn't stream or whatever, didn't release on home video. But I just want to see it because I've heard horrible things. But
yeah,
I've never...
it's bad. It's bad.
Was Randy Quaid in the cast that year?
Yes, he was. So that was the year. So they were coming off the year where they brought in all ringers, right?
Billy Crystal, Martin Short, Harry Shearer, Christopher Guest.
Yeah. So they bring in all ringers. But all those guys did it, and they all were very successful. They didn't need to do this show, and so the idea was, well, we'll do one just because we've always wanted to do it, right? And so we'll do one and done. And so when they couldn't re-up any of them, they were like, well, let's bring in ringers again. And so they brought in Randy Quaid, Anthony Michael Hall, Robert Downey Jr.
Joan Cusack.
Was this a Lorne Michaels year?
No.
So this is when he was gone.
So Damon Wayans. He was not a name yet.
Pre In Living Color?
Yes. So he famously breaks character in a sketch and gets fired. Maybe Lorne Michaels was there for the Randy Quaid.
Yeah, I think after the Billy Crystal, et cetera, I think that was the last of those 5 years that Michaels was away, and then he came back and brought
those because I remember Lorne Michaels gets mad because Damon Wayans breaks character, and he fires him in mid-show.
Jeez.
And supposedly Damon Wayans did it because he wanted to go to Living Color.
Oh.
Because he wasn't getting screen time there anyway.
Right.
Okay.
And so he's like, well, I'd rather go do this show where it's going to be, it's going to be more Black driven and I'll get more screen time.
Made the right move for his career.
And because the Homeboy Shopping Network actually started as a sketch on SNL. It was him and Anthony Michael Hall.
And he was able to take it with him.
It always amazed me that they let him do that. Yeah. I wasn't sure how he got away with that.
Especially if it ended on bad terms. For sure.
But you can see a version of that sketch with him and Anthony Michael Hall. In fact, I think they did it a couple times.
Okay.
But yeah, that season is awful. But yeah, they bring back in Lorne Michaels. And I think now that I think Lorne Michaels was like, they were coming off such a great season. He was like, well, I'll emulate that because if I bring in nobodies,
they're going to expect names.
Yeah. And then when that season, then he brings in, he goes back to rebuilding a cast with up-and-comers from scratch. And that's the Dana Carvey, Phil Hartman.
Jan Hooks,
Nora Dunn.
John Lovitz.
And I think John Lovitz had been, he's one of the few people that carried over. Because John Lovitz had been in that Randy Quaid. Because I think you saw the devil character pop up a couple times that season.
Okay.
But yeah, almost everybody else got blown out.
Interesting. Yeah. So yeah, so I think that the movie ends with some great dramatic scenes with the courtrooms. I kind of like that Strauss. I kind of like they gave you a bad guy. I think that I think that's something that, you know, for moviegoers to relate to. It really happened. So we talked about, I think it's important for the story. It gives you someone to root against. They have that good scene at the end where his staffer, Ehrenreich, is kind of like, you know, screw you, go on out. Like the press are all there and he comes in and he's like, did I get it? And he's like, I didn't get it. And you get to see his defeat. So you get that kind of comeuppance for him. Yeah, I really enjoyed this movie. I it was long, but I never looked at my watch. You know, it didn't feel long to me, at least. That was interesting. And I felt like I learned something too.
I know I made fun of the runtime a little bit. I have to say, in fairness, I did a true Barbenheimer, so I had seen Barbie immediately prior. So
okay,
this was
that's a long day
for 5 hours of movies.
Wow.
But overall, I liked this movie, but I don't think it's this flawless masterpiece that some people are proclaiming it.
Yeah, I don't think it's great either. I think it's okay. I think I gave it a 6.5 out of 10 on my website. You know, it's not horrible, and if people go to see it, they're not going to walk out of there going, that was a waste of time.
Yeah.
But I don't think they're coming out, oh, Christopher Nolan is God.
I think it's just, you know, this happened so long ago. I mean, when you look at the numbers, it doesn't seem that long ago, and, you know, people are still alive from the era, but it also was a long time ago. Like, for someone even my age or my son's age, I mean, it's so far removed that people can't really understand the whole, you know, being under nuclear threat and all this stuff that was happening. And, you know, now we know we have wars and weapons and all this stuff is so futuristic now. But like back then, I mean, this stuff was getting invented. And I don't know, I think it's an important film to understand how the world changed based on what Oppenheimer did and the decisions that we made. And it seems like an important movie. So I'm glad it's made, and you have someone like Nolan that, because his name's attached to it, people will see it. You know, you're not going to, this isn't a little art house movie. It's not one of those where it's just going to run the art house circuit because Nolan's attached. It's a big movie. We should mention too, $100 million budget, right? Like that's for movies these days, you know, they're always talking about how movies have a $200, $300 million budget and they're losing money. Look what happens. You give Nolan $100 million. He's a guy that comes in on time and under budget consistently. $100 million budget, opens to 80, 50 million second week. You know, I'm sure we'll have a strong third week. It's like, keep those budgets, you know, in the mid-level.
I think you're going to see mid-level. More and more of that. I think
they want to have movies in theaters, they're
going to
have to.
I think they're seeing that it's getting harder and harder to put out, I was going to say, a mediocre movie and make a ton of money, but it's even hard to put out a good movie and make a ton of money. And I think that you're going to see budgets really tighten up on movies. I saw an article just the other day. They're saying that a Dungeons and Dragons sequel is not out of the question, but they were like, we got to figure out how to make it cheaper. They're like, if you want to do another one of these, you got to bring those costs down.
So I didn't even realize that one had that big of a budget, but
I don't think it did. I think it had like $100 million, which is in today's world for a movie like
for
that.
For a big fantasy.
But they said that they think, you know, if they can get it down to 80.
Okay.
Because it ended up breaking even.
Yeah.
And so they were like, if you can get this budget down.
And make a good sequel.
I can tell you that 1989's Fat Man and Little Boy was a bomb. I don't mean the bomb.
Yeah, like, it did not do well at all. Yeah.
No, it didn't. And my question is, what was the last non-IP movie? You know, a movie not based on existing intellectual property. I know this is based on a book, but that's not what I mean.
Right.
You know, Mission Impossible.
Barbie is an IP.
Barbie.
Right.
Marvel, obviously, is all
IP. You know, Indiana Jones, all the superhero movies, all of that. Has there been an original movie that did anywhere near this in years?
Boy, I really have to think. Like I
mean, Everything Everywhere All at Once
is
probably the most recent I can think of, because that is very original.
Yeah.
Now I don't know, after the Oscars and leading up because of the Oscar buzz, I know that it was like re-released and in more theaters and went wide after it was getting the buzz. So, you know, it didn't have a huge opening, but it did have one of those that it had legs
that for, was a big hit,
but
in the long run.
But I don't not It didn't make this much, but for its small budget, remember that's an A24, you know,
right.
So they do pretty small budgets, and it made tons. Like, it was a huge multiplier on its budget. So,
I mean, I know it's a sequel, but it's a sequel to a non-existing IP, but Avatar, I mean, he created that from whole cloth.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look at 2022, I think the first movie that's not off of a pre-existing IP comes in at number 14. It's Nope.
Hmm.
You have at number one, Top Gun Maverick. I'm just going to go and starting at number one and work backwards. Top Gun, Black Panther, Doctor Strange, Avatar, Jurassic World Dominion, Minions, Batman, Thor, Spider-Man, Sonic the Hedgehog. Now, that's the top 10. Coming in 11, Black Adam, Elvis, which I think you could argue is an IP,
right? Yeah.
At this point. Uncharted, which is a video game, in case you're unfamiliar.
Mm-hmm. I'm not.
And then Nope comes in at 14, Lightyear at 15, Smile at 16, which is a horror movie, but is an original, as far as I know.
Okay.
The Lost City, not an IP, but it's basically a remake of Romancing the Stone. And then Bullet Train, which is not an IP, but is a John Wick knockoff.
Oh, yeah.
And so Bad Guys. So you start to get into some non-IP stuff, but...
Bad Guys, the animated?
Yeah.
That's a book.
Is it a book? Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
It's a kid's book.
You know what? I give him a pass if it was a book.
Yeah.
Because book so to movie is so different from movie to sequel
true.
Movie.
True.
For
true.
Sure. Or comic book to movie.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, Fantastic Beasts, DC League of Super Pets... And then 22, Where the Crawdads Sing, which is also a book.
Yeah.
But Black Phone.
Black Phone's original. I mean, well, I mean, that's a short story.
It was a short story. I would say it was a book. It was a short story.
But would you call that an IP? That's not an IP, though.
No. Not an IP, yeah.
I mean, that's like saying To Kill a Mockingbird was IP.
Right, right. Yeah. Sing 2, Scream, Morbius. I mean, almost
everything.
Almost everything.
Which is why, like, the head scratcher, why do they just make sequels? And you know, it's like, you know, for the business.
Well, there's two sides of that. One is that's the only thing that's in the theaters. And the other one is, well, we tried to make middle-level comedies, people and nobody went to see a $30 million movie.
Yeah.
So... Everything Everywhere All at Once had a $14.3 to $25 million budget. So we'll call it $25 million. We'll just say that was what it was. So it opened. Its domestic opening was only $500,000, right? So very small opening. It's an art house movie, limited opening, $500,000. It ended up with $77.1 million domestic, $64 million overseas, $141.2 million on a $25 million at the highest budget. Yeah. So, you know, sometimes they take off like that. And so that's probably maybe one of the most successful
returns. Yeah, that's a great example. Yep.
Yeah.
But again, like money-wise, like to make hundreds of millions of dollars off original IP, like it didn't break $200 million, and Oppenheimer in 3 weeks will break $200 million domestic.
Without the benefit of hot dog fingers.
Yeah, without, right? Which, I mean, yeah, that's just make everything better. But yeah, I think it's great that when a director of Nolan's stature can attach his name to an important film, and a film that has so much to do with the world we live in and a historical significance, can attach his film and, again, elevate it from this is a really good art house story that is important to now you've got a lot of people seeing this and a lot of people that maybe never knew anything about it. I guarantee, you know, kids, teenagers, 20s, they're showing up to see a Nolan movie and I bet you they know nothing about the history of this, right?
It seems unlikely. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's what's cool is that that he can do this and, you know, cause he could just make more Batman movies or Tenet or his original ideas, but like he thought this was important to tell.
Yeah. Back to SNL real quick. It was season 11.
Okay.
It is available on Peacock.
Okay, wow.
And there were a couple cast members that carried over into the next year. John Lovitz, Nora Dunn, and Dennis Miller are all in that. Hmm. Damon Wayans was a featured player, but not a full cast member.
Gotcha.
Okay.
So, but yeah, it is all available on Peacock if you want to go check it out. So, and it was really bad.
Yeah.
Oh, I should also say, in terms of SNL history, it's the that is the season with the first Black female cast member, Denitra Vance,
yeah.
Who I think out of that season has the best sketch called That Black Girl. And it was a parody of the show That Girl.
Yeah.
And for people that aren't familiar with That Girl, it was a show from the late 60s starring Marlo Thomas as a single gal in the city. And it always had a cold open. And the cold open always ended with somebody being like, oh, you know who we need? We need That Girl. And then the camera would zoom over on her and it'd be like her doing something cutesy and then opening credits and off to the races.
Yeah, okay.
And the premise of this sketch is like she's auditioning for something and they're like we need That Girl, and then like nothing happens, like you're expecting the camera to do all that, nothing happens, and it's like all white girls and Denitra Vance, and then they're like, which girl would that be? The one on the end, That Girl. Ugh. And then nothing happens. And then it's like, I'm sorry, I don't know what you mean, the one all the way to the end, the cute one, the bubbly one, the okay, that black girl. And then, like, the camera does all this stuff.
Yeah.
It's really, and, like, she wrote the sketch. Like, yeah. It's not, like,
right.
Yeah, like,
right.
It's the highlight of that season.
Was okay. Terry Kenny in that cast also? I think he was the first out cast member.
Oh, yeah, yeah. SNL. Terry Sweeney. Yeah,
right.
Yeah, yeah. Terry Sweeney. Yes, he is in that season as
okay.
well.
Yeah.
Because I remember he does a sketch where, oh, no, that's the season that Ron Reagan Jr. is on, and they do a parody of Risky Business, like Ronald Reagan's gone, and he's in the White House.
Yes.
Yeah.
In the shirt and the underwear.
Yeah. Yeah. So we are off on a tangent, which is what we do. So
sure.
So anyway, that's it for this one. Let's go around the table and everyone can say where to find them.
This is Paul. You can find me on my website, harrisonline.com.
This is Kevin. Follow me on Twitter at Kevin R. Brackett.
And this is Tom. You can follow me on Twitter at Roger Kubert or on Facebook at facebook.com/Tom O'Keefe. You can find the show online at facebook.com/Real Spoilers. While you're there, like the page, join the group. And of course, don't forget our YouTube channel where you can watch all of these shows now in color. So that's it for this one. Thanks for tuning in. And until next time, Norman St. Savage clones his favorite seamstress.
Get ready for a spoiler. Won't say it twice because we already warned you. Better watch out. It's gonna ruin the plot.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.